Today is Monday, December 11th, year 2000. We're in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Charles Patrick Lash LaRue for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial. The university will be commemorating this in the year 2005. As you can see, Lash, we have a tape recorder for this oral history, and do you give us permission to tape this interview?
Correct, I did.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some personal educational background. Where were you born, and where did you go to school prior to going to college?
Portland, how far back do we go?
At the beginning, I guess.
Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And because I was a cradle Catholic, I went to Madeline Grade School, a Catholic grade school in Portland. I followed that by going to another Catholic school, Columbia Preparatory, which was a Catholic high school in Portland. Then I went to the University of Washington in Seattle. Do we need dates for this?
Well, only if you want to put them in, that makes it a little easier, as you recall. Well,
I can't remember when I started grade school, but I was born in 1916, so it must have been 22, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wait a minute.
21?
Oh,
five
six,
years?
Eight. Six. Must have been 24.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I got out, then I got out of grade school, 1930, I think it was. Started Columbia Prep in 30, graduated in 34. I started at the University of Washington in 1936. There's a gap between finishing high school and starting college, 2-year gap.
That was during the Depression.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when I think of that, it's really bizarre in a way. I never doubted that I'd go to college, and yet I didn't have the money to go to college.
Really?
So when I finished high school, I enlisted in the Army. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, you could sign up for 3 years, and every year, the Army admitted 2 enlisted men to West Point by a national competitive exam. But see, in those days, the Army was only, I don't know, 180,000 men, mm-hmm. most of whom were World War I vets who stayed on. And you know, when I think of the World War I and World War II, it seems like a long period between the two. But it's really only, what, roughly 21 years.
21 years.
So to say somebody was a World War I vet and he's still actively in the Army is not all that peculiar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, most of the people were World War I, or they were semi-literate kids who maybe didn't even go to high school, came off the farm or something. So an uncle of mine who was a West Pointer said, look, he said, you enlist in the Army, you take this competitive exam, you'll be one of the 2 winners, and you go to West Point and you get a fine college education, and if you want to stay in the Army, you can. If not, you know, you've got that education. So I went across the river to Vancouver, Washington, enlisted in the Army. No recruiting stations the way there are now, you know, in cities. So I went to Fort Vancouver, I guess they called it, signed up, sailed through the physical exam with no reservation at all. They sent me down to the Presidio San Francisco, and after about 6 months, I was in the infantry there, 3rd Division, which I just noticed the other day when I got a letter from a brother of mine that this stamp has a picture of Audie Murphy. Be familiar with him.
And highly decorated World War II your hero.
Number mm-hmm. one decorated, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's got a 3rd Division shoulder patch and it's in the stamp. Mm-hmm. So that brought back memories. Mm-hmm. So anyway, about 6 months after I'm in the Army, the captain called me in and said, I understand you're interested in competing for admission to West Point. I said, yeah. Well, he said, the first step is to have a physical exam. I said, I just had one. Well, he said, the standards are higher for West Point than there are for enlisted
personnel. For the infantry.
Well, I went over to the hospital there, and by the time that physical exam was through, I thought I was ready for the grave. I had some degree of flat feet. Eyesight wasn't up to par. Malocclusion, which I discovered means your teeth don't fit properly. I don't know if I had a heart murmur, but anyway, that just eliminated any hope of going to West Point because mm-hmm. I couldn't pass the physical. So I saved up my money. I was getting paid $21 a month, and I saved $15. Well, out of the 21, the Army took $3 for something. I don't know what it was. So I'm really talking net of 18 a month. I saved 15 a month for 8 months, and I bought myself out of the Army.
Oh, right.
But just before I did, I was a model. Are you familiar with the difference between a garrison soldier and a field soldier?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was a good garrison soldier. You know, my equipment was all shiny.
Boots were shiny.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, people criticize me nowadays for being compulsive. You know, I like to line things up squarely with the edge of the table and that kind of thing. While I was at the Presidio, a general was coming out from Washington, that's long before the Pentagon was built, to inspect the 3rd Division there. So in order to make sure that the beds were properly made, you know how in the Army you're supposed to be able to drop a quarter on a bed in the blanket and it'll bounce up. Somebody, I don't know, division commander, somebody went around all the barracks looking at the way the beds were made, picked mine, we carried it out onto the parade ground. The whole damn regiment, it wasn't a division, they were a regiment, they had to go by and inspect my bed. I didn't know whether to be proud of that or embarrassed by that.
Put that on your resume.
So I was a good garrison soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I got out, and just before I got out, the Army, there was a some kind of international exposition in San Diego in 1935, and the Presidio made up a company of men, all matched by pretty much by height, you know, so they looked uniform. No pun intended there, but anyway. And they picked out people who were good garrison soldiers, and 120 of them, I was one of them, went down and we built a camp in the fairgrounds, a model Army camp, you know, with a floor and a frame and then a pyramidal tent on top of that, and a company street with crushed oyster shells and boundaries, and a beautiful example of peacetime Army. So I was down there, and one day a guy came in and he says, "Hey, LaRue," he says, "there's a guy looking for you, and he's wearing a uniform and he's packing a gun." I thought, "My God, what have I done?" Well, it turned out it was a deputy sheriff who somehow or other was assigned the job of delivering to me a letter from a law firm in New York someplace, informing me that I had just inherited $5,000. I didn't even know the uncle who left me that money.
Wow.
So the first thing I did, after I had saved up enough money to buy myself out, so I didn't have to touch the $5,000 for that. But the first thing I did was I bought a car. It was a 36 Ford. It was used. It had a convertible top, but it was a four-door car. It's quite a rarity. If I had it now, it probably worth $500,000. But I wasn't smart enough to hang on to it. So I bought that car, toured all around the U.S., went on down to Mexico City and back. Never gave a thought to the possibility I might have a breakdown or a flat or anything. Just took off.
Good, reliable Ford. Huh?
Yeah. And then I enrolled at the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. And that amount of money carried me through that $4,000. Took me through 4 years of college. But unlike what you might have expected from a guy who'd been in the Army and seen what it's like if you don't have an education and would consequently be a mature, hardworking student, I was a George Bush kind of student. Drinking, frat boy, the whole works.
You were.
But somewhere along the line.
So your scholarly work you don't remember that much of as an undergraduate?
You know, I actually got a very good education, but it was only because I had to go every quarter to see my academic advisor, who would sign off on the courses I was going to take that quarter. He was a professor of Greek, and I never took any Greek, but I was assigned to him. And he would say to me, and I've recommended this to people over the years now that I've been a prof, he'd say to me, "LaRue, do you know anything about architecture?" I'd say, "No." "Well, we've got an excellent person teaching a course in architectural appreciation or something." or you know anything about American Lit? I'd say, no. Well, we've got a really fine person teaching that this term. You should take it. So it wasn't the subject so much he directed me into, but it was the person teaching it. And in that way, I got a really broad liberal education.
Yeah.
And picked up a lot by osmosis because I was half in the bag a lot of the time when I was in class.
You feel your Catholic education, primary education, prepared you well for
it? Very definitely, yeah. I was way ahead when it came to writing of my contemporaries in grade in high school. Well, I can't say in high school because they were all in the same school. At the university, I was. Yeah, mm-hmm. It really paid off. And when I was teaching here, I could spot a student who came from a Catholic high school.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Reading an essay exam, mm-hmm. The person would write. I'd say, "You went to a Catholic high school, didn't you?" I'd say, "Why? How do you know that?" I'd say, "I read your exam, and you can write."
That's interesting. At the University of Washington, what did you major in?
It was called General Studies.
Oh, okay.
Probably doesn't exist anymore, but it should, mm-hmm. because if a student who approached college the way I did can get a good education, that's a testimonial to a good General Studies program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't have any specific. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just, as a matter of fact, it's really strange. You ever read the Saturday Evening Post?
I did. Yeah.
Well, I grew up reading that, mm-hmm. and there was a series about a guy who sold heavy earth-moving equipment. And somehow or other, that'd really be a fine way to make a living, sell earth-moving equipment. Mm-hmm. But that's what I was going to do when I mm-hmm. got out of college.
When you graduated, what did you go into, or what ultimately?
Well, when I graduated from the University of Washington, I had no idea still what I wanted to do. And here again, I didn't get through in 4 years. It took me about 6 years of attendance with 4 years out for military service during mm-hmm. World War II. So when I came back, I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I figured, well, I've got the GI Bill. So, you know, my up to the master's level or something can be paid for, so why don't I take advantage of that? So I thought economics might be a good subject to take because I was interested in participating in social reform in a kind of a vague way. And I figured if you want to do that, it'd be useful to know something about the economy. So when I was an undergraduate, I took a beginning econ course. It would now be called microeconomics. That was before Keynesian economics mm-hmm. came into existence, so there wasn't any macro at that time. But this was a course in a big amphitheater, probably 300 of us, with a prof down there who couldn't be improved on by central casting, a big heavy-set guy, no offense. But a three-piece suit with a watch chain and a Phi Beta Kappa, mm-hmm. and the dullest guy that I ever listened to in my life. And I thought, boy, this is the subject I'm going to avoid like the plague. Mm-hmm. But then when I got out of the Army and came back to school, I thought, well, economics is a good subject for me, so I took it. And I was never bitten by the economics bug. I don't think, as I look back on it, I never really thought like an economist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've hung out much mm-hmm. with economists, but if you do, a quality they typically have is they can't talk about anything without subjecting it to some form of economic analysis, and they'll use the jargon of the trade all the time. And I never did that. Some of my colleagues wonder if I knew any economics. And I didn't know as much as I probably should have, but mm-hmm. I found out I really wasn't much interested in economics. I liked teaching beginning mm-hmm. economics, but what I really liked teaching was labor relations and labor law mm-hmm. at the undergraduate level. So that's what I wound up doing.
Would you talk a little bit about your war service? How did that come about?
You're not going to get very far with this tape.
That's right. I've got lots of tape.
On a tangent like that.
I've got lots of tape. That's important.
Well,
because there you feel it shape your experience and your later life.
It did. Mm-hmm. But the reason I cautioned you about mm-hmm. how it's a long story is this. Here I was a goof off in school, but I had a social conscience that somehow was awakened, which led me to withdraw from the university I belonged to when they wouldn't take in a Hawaiian mm-hmm. football player.
Oh, really?
Really nice guy. As a matter of fact, talk about an extreme bigotry. Here I was in a fraternity in Seattle, Washington, Sigma Chi fraternity, as you might guess in view of this sordid record. We were informed by the national office that the Prince of Siam, who I think he was studying at Princeton or someplace, what's Siam? Thailand now, mm-hmm. I guess. The Prince of Siam was on his way back home from the eastern part of the U.S. He was going to go through Seattle, and he would like to drop out and meet the boys, the brothers, at the frat house. They took a vote. No, we don't want him. He's the N-word or some damn thing.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. It was shortly after that. Somehow that went by me, and I didn't protest that. Well, I argued, why the hell are we not inviting this guy? God, I'd love to meet the Prince of Siam. Oh, no. He's not a white man. But then I proposed this Hawaiian football player, who's really a great guy for membership, and they turned him down, so I figured I've had it. So I moved off and rented a houseboat on the lake near the university with mm-hmm. four other guys. It was a big improvement over at the fraternity house. But anyway, along the way, see, somehow I developed this social conscience, and I began in the late 30s reading pacifist literature. People like Gandhi, Nehru. There was an American named Gregg, I think, G-R-E-G-G, that was his last name, who wrote about pacifism and the futility of war, etc. And I guess, and you ever hear of the Oxford Pledge, or maybe it's the Swedish Pledge, mm-hmm. I don't know. There was a debate at Oxford on the question, will we, being the college generation in the 30s, will we let ourselves be used as cannon fodder the way our uncles and etc. were in World War I? I think the people who debated, yes, we will, we'll rally around to the flag, I think they won, but the losing side then circulated a petition, or a statement, which I think was signed by people all around the world, saying, I will not be used as cannon fodder in any future war. Well, I never got a chance to sign that thing, but I would have if I had seen it, and that's a small regret I have that I can't say I signed that thing, Stockholm Pledge or something. So anyway, I was casting around after I had signed up for the draft. What would I do? I knew I couldn't claim that I was a conscientious objector because the Catholic Church didn't approve of that. So while I was pondering that, I heard about an outfit that had headquarters in New York, which had contracted with Chrysler to buy Dodge ambulances. That's the kind of the Army. You mm-hmm. see them in MASH. You know, mm-hmm. It was that kind of an ambulance. They had these ambulances on order, and they were going to give them to the French because this outfit was called the American Field Service, had been established in World War I. When, if I remember correctly, the Battle at Verdun produced so many casualties, it exhausted the French medical corps' ability to get these people back away from the battle area. So American expatriates in Paris somehow got their hands on pickup trucks and vans and vehicles of one kind or another, drove up to the front at Verdun and brought these people back, and then they formed a permanent organization which kept it alive during the two wars, I think mainly because most of the people in it in World War I were well-to-do New Englanders, you know, Ivy League types, mm-hmm. with money, so they kept it alive, and when World War II came on, they ordered these ambulances, they were going to provide them the French, and they were going to provide volunteer drivers as well. But France fell so quickly, they had to do something with these things. They're coming off the assembly line, so they offered them to the French who were fighting the Germans in Syria, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was Lebanon and Syria. Anyway, that didn't take very long for the Germans to resolve that. So they still have these ambulances, and they had people who signed up to drive them. So they offered them to the British. And so I signed on with this for a year as a volunteer ambulance driver, and was sent. I went back to New York on my own, and the ship left from Brooklyn. And we went down along the Atlantic coast in this passenger ship converted to a troop ship. But you could misunderstand that term troop ship if I don't explain that here was a passenger boat designed to carry 54 passengers, and there were only 110 of us, so it wasn't exactly crowded. Had a swimming pool, four meals a day, lie out on the deck in the sun. Mm-hmm. But as we're going down the Atlantic coast, I saw one ship after another that had been hit by a torpedo and had run aground. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, up on the shore there.
So the German U-boats were operating in the area?
They were, yeah. And there was something in the paper just recently about mm-hmm. about that. Oh, it was the fact that the British had broken the German code, mm-hmm. and they knew that there were U-boats operating on the shore. But we went down all by ourselves to Trinidad, mm-hmm. and seeing these ships made me a little bit nervous, but one of the reasons it's good to have young people fight wars is they think they're immortal, so they don't...
It won't be me.
You can't scare them very well. But anyway, we went by ourselves to Trinidad, Port of Spain, Trinidad, formed a big convoy, then went around the southern part of South Africa. We couldn't go into the Mediterranean. The German and Italian Air Force controlled that. Down around South Africa, stopped off in Cape Town for... I think 2 weeks or something like that in an army camp. Then they took a train to Durban and got aboard the New Amsterdam, which was a beautiful passenger ship. But there were 8,000 of us on that, designed for maybe 300. But one of the nice things about this outfit I was in was we bought our uniforms at Abercrombie and Fitch. I was really glamorized by that idea. Bush jackets, and you know, was young and thin, you look pretty good in one of those outfits. Shorts, long socks, you know, that you associate a British colonial mm-hmm. manager of a rubber plantation or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, nobody could tell in the British Army what we were. We weren't enlisted men and we weren't officers. So they resolved that in favor of we're officers, which meant 8,000 troops are out on the deck. They can't even get a beer. Mm-hmm. We can hit the bar with the officer's bar around 7 p.m. and close it around midnight or something.
So the British class system won out.
Oh, that it sure did. And then we went on up from South Africa into the Red Sea and got off at Port Said, took a train from there out to the into the desert, and this was September 42. Now, if you're an historian of World War II, you mm-hmm. know that October 42 was the Battle of El Alamein, the first mm-hmm. major victory the Allies won in World War II, I believe, on land anyway. So we got there just 1 month before the El Alamein battle, and spent that time out in the desert training how to operate in the desert. Now, we never had to use it, but we had something called a sun compass, which was mounted by the driver's, on the left side of the driver's door, and it was a metal plate about maybe 6 inches in diameter, and then a sort of a spike, which was about 6 inches high, in the center of it, which cast a shadow. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how we used that in detail, but somehow you lined the vehicle up using a metal compass, true north. Mm-hmm. Then that, so you're heading true north, and you see where the shadow falls on this metal base. And somehow, by keeping the shadow where it is when you're going, let's say, 40 degrees or 60 degrees, you could go maybe 10 miles into the trackless desert and find a 50-gallon drum out there. That was your target. And the theory, of course, was because the desert was like being in the ocean, mm-hmm. a good part of the desert has no shrubs, nothing, just flat, hard sand so you can drive mm-hmm. in it. So we spent a month learning how to do that and how to maintain the ambulance in the sand and whatnot. We had a grease gun, and we'd have to grease, I think the term is splines, mm-hmm. which have something to do with, you know, the parts that move around have to do with the steering of the mm-hmm. vehicle. We'd pump this grease in until we couldn't see any sand coming through the thing. Then we knew that we'd gotten all the sand out of the thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you don't do that, mm-hmm. you get to the point where, well, what happened to that episode in Iran? Remember when the Delta Force tried to rescue those people?
Yep.
And their helicopters couldn't operate in the sand? Mm-hmm. We resolved that, of course, a lot simpler with those ambulances, by greasing those things every evening. Mm-hmm.
Did you have training in first aid? First aid, or was mostly just...
No, all we did was we would drive up to what was called a battalion aid station, which mm-hmm. would probably be, maybe 700 yards or something back from the front line. And that would be where somebody who was wounded would get the elementary treatment and mm-hmm. Put a tourniquet on or whatever. And then we'd pick up the wounded. We had four stretchers. And if we were going to pick up walking wounded, we had benches on each side that folded down. And so you could get something like eight walking wounded in there comfortably, mm-hmm. as against four on the stretchers. So we'd pick them up at the battalion aid station, take them back to another part of the medical service called a casualty clearing station, which I think it was very much like what you see on MASH on mm-hmm. television. Mm-hmm. They would take the bandages off, do a little surgery, then we take them back to a hospital in Cairo, mm-hmm. let's say, or to some larger, more permanent hospital. No, we didn't do any first aid, but I ran into another idiotic example of racial bigotry. I noticed after I got to New York and saw some of the other people who were going to go on this enterprise with me, there were no blacks. Well, you know, the blacks weren't serving in the American Army either mm-hmm. in those days. But I said, how come no blacks? Some guy said, well, we thought about it, but we decided that given the attitude so many whites have toward blacks, if a soldier, a white soldier, is on his back out on the battlefield and he's being picked up to be put in your ambulance and he sees a black face, he might have a heart attack and die. That was in the days when the Red Cross wouldn't take black blood, uh-huh. see, because somebody might think that it would contaminate him. Mm-hmm.
So how long did you end up serving in the in that force?
I got there just in time for the El Alamein battle. And we pursued the Africa Corps, I put it that way because there was an Italian mm-hmm. Component of the Africa Corps. They were side by side, but they surrendered so quickly, it was really the Africa Corps. All the way across North Africa, when we got to Tripoli, where Gaddafi now has his headquarters, we stopped and Winston Churchill flew out and addressed the British 8th Army, and we were part of it because we were attached to various divisions of the British 8th Army. And it was one of those, was it Henry VIII, we band of brothers or something mm-hmm. kind of speech, you know, nobody will ever forget you, which of course I know now, baloney, nobody ever heard of it, us being in Tripoli. But mm-hmm. And then we continued on to, I got as far as Tunisia. And by that time the Americans had landed in Algeria and they were closing the gap between the British 8th Army and the American forces, and the African Corps was squeezed in between. So I was sent, by this time I was I looked, if you saw me, you'd think I was a first lieutenant in the British Army. I had two pips. And I managed to look like an officer. And I was responsible for something like 30 ambulances. I had a motorcycle part of the time and a Jeep part of the time to deal with the people I was responsible for, because the way we moved across the desert was to position all the vehicles, tanks, trucks, every vehicle, I think something like 150 yards from the next vehicle. So they're, if this is my ambulance and this is another one, there's 150 yards this way, 150 yards that way. And that turned out to be helpful, because every once in a while the Germans would swoop down and bomb convoys and whatnot. And there were some times when you had to stay on a road because the ground wouldn't be passable, and you were really a nice target for a Stuka to come.
Mm-hmm. For strafing, yeah.
Come down strafe. So if I was going to get the word out to the 30 ambulances, I couldn't do it on foot very well, so they gave me a motorcycle for part of the time and a Jeep part of the time. Mm-hmm. And then they sent me up to Aleppo, Syria. And I drove through what was then Palestine from Cairo with a bridge.